Chapter 152. To my companion's better sense, however, I remained where I was. All this time, kept fresh by a certain enjoyment of the work in which he was engaged, he was up and down at every house we came to, addressing people whom he had never beheld before as old acquaintances, running in to warm himself at every fire he saw, talking and drinking and shaking hands at every bar and tap, friendly with every wagoner, wheelwright, blacksmith, and toll taker, yet never seeming to lose time, and always mounting to the box again with his watchful, steady face and his business-like, "Get on, my lad." When we were changing horses the next time, he came from the stable yard, with the wet snow encrusted upon him, and dropping off him plashing and crashing through it to his wet knees as he had been doing frequently since we left St. Albans, and spoke to me at the carriage side. "Keep up your spirits. It's certainly true that she came on here, Miss Summerson. There's not a doubt of the dress by this time, and the dress has been seen here."
"Still on foot?"
said one.
"Still on foot.
I think the gentleman you mentioned must be the point she's aiming at, and yet I don't like his living down in her own part of the country neither."
"I know so little," said one.
"There may be someone else nearer here, of whom I never heard."
"That's true.
But whatever you do, don't you fall a-crying, my dear, and don't you worry yourself no more than you can help. Get on, my lad." The sleet fell all that day unceasingly, a thick mist came on early, and it never rose or lightened for a moment. Such roads I had never seen. I sometimes feared we had missed the way, and got into the plowed grounds or the marshes. If I ever thought of the time I had been out, it presented itself as an indefinite period of great duration, and I seemed, in a strange way, never to have been free from the anxiety under which I then labored. As we advanced, I began to feel misgivings that my companion lost confidence. He was the same as before with all the roadside people, but he looked graver when he sat by himself on the box. I saw his finger uneasily going across and across his mouth during the whole of one long weary stage. I overheard that he began to ask the drivers of coaches and other vehicles coming towards us what passengers they had seen in other coaches and vehicles that were in advance. Their replies did not encourage him. He always gave me a reassuring beck of his finger and lift of his eyelid as he got upon the box again. But he seemed perplexed now when he said, "Get on, my lad." At last, when we were changing, he told me that he had lost the track of the dress so long that he began to be surprised. It was nothing, he said, to lose such a track for one while, and to take it up for another while, and so on. But it had disappeared here in an unaccountable manner, and we had not come upon it since. This corroborated the apprehensions I had formed when he began to look at direction posts and to leave the carriage at crossroads for a quarter of an hour at a time while he explored them. But I was not to be downhearted, he told me, for it was as likely as not that the next stage might set us right again. The next stage, however, ended as that one ended. We had no new clue. There was a spacious inn here, solitary, but a comfortable substantial building, and as we drove in under a large gateway, before I knew it, where a landlady and her pretty daughters came to the carriage door, entreating me to alight and refresh myself, while the horses were making ready, I thought it would be uncharitable to refuse. They took me upstairs to a warm room, and left me there. It was at the corner of the house, I remember, looking two ways. On one side to a stable yard open to a by-road, where the hostlers were unharnessing the splashed and tired horses from the muddy carriage, and beyond that to the by-road itself, across which the sign was heavily swinging. On the other side to a wood of dark pine trees. Their branches were encumbered with snow, and it silently dropped off in wet heaps while I stood at the window. Night was setting in, and its bleakness was enhanced by the contrast of the pictured fire glowing and gleaming in the window pane.
As I looked among the stems of the trees, and followed the discolored marks in the snow, where the thaw was sinking into it and undermining it, I thought of the motherly face brightly set off by daughters, that had just now welcomed me, and of my mother lying down in such a wood to die. I was frightened when I found them all about me, but I remembered that, before I fainted I tried very hard not to do it, and that was some little comfort. They cushioned me up on a large sofa by the fire, and then the comely landlady told me that I must travel no further tonight, but must go to bed. But this put me into such a tremble lest they should detain me there, that she soon recalled her words and calm promised for a rest of half an hour. A good endearing creature she was. She and her three fair girls, also busy about me. I was to take hot soup and broiled fowl, while Mr. Bucket dried himself and dined elsewhere. But I could not do it, when a snug round table was presently spread by the fireside, though I was very unwilling to disappoint them. However, I could take some toast and some hot negus, and as I really enjoyed that refreshment, it made some recompense. Punctual to the time, at the half-hour's end the carriage came rumbling under the gateway, and they took me down, warmed, refreshed, comforted by kindness, and safe, I assured them, not to faint any more. After I had got in, and had taken a grateful leave of them all, the youngest daughter, a blooming girl of 19, who was to be the first married, they had told me got upon the carriage step, reached in, and kissed me. I have never seen her, from that hour, but I think of her to this hour as my friend. The transparent windows with the fire and light, looking so bright and warm from the cold darkness out of doors, were soon gone, and again we were crushing and churning the loose snow. We went on with toil enough, but the dismal roads were not much worse than they had been, and the stage was only 9 miles. My companion smoking on the box I had thought at the last in of begging him to do so, when I saw him standing at a great fire in a comfortable cloud of tobacco was as vigilant as ever and as quickly down and up again, when we came to any human abode or any human creature. He had lighted his little dark lantern, which seemed to be a favorite with him, for we had lamps to the carriage. And every now and then he turned it upon me to see that I was doing well. There was a folding window to the carriage head, but I never closed it, for it seemed like shutting out hope. We came to the end of the stage, and still the lost trace was not recovered. I looked at him anxiously when we stopped to change, but I knew by his yet graver face as he stood watching the ostlers that he had heard nothing. Almost in an instant afterwards, as I leaned back in my seat, he looked in, with his lighted lantern in his hand, an excited and quite different man. "What is it?" said I, starting. "Is she here?" "No, no. Don't deceive yourself, my dear. Nobody's here. But I've got it." The crystallized snow was in his eyelashes, in his hair, lying in ridges on his dress. He had to shake it from his face, and get his breath, before he spoke to me. "Now, Miss Summerson," said he, beating his finger on the apron, "don't you be disappointed at what I may going to do. You know me. I'm Inspector Bucket, and you can trust me. We've come a long way, never mind. 4 horses out there for the next stage up. Quick." There was a commotion in the yard, and a man came running out of the stables to know if he meant up or down. "Up, I tell you. Up. Ain't it English? Up. Up," said I, astonished. "To London. Are we going back?" "Miss Summerson," he answered, "back. Straight back as a die. You know me. Don't be afraid. I'll follow the other, by G, the other?" I repeated. "Who? You called her Jenny, didn't you? I'll follow her. Bring those 2 pair out here for a crown a man. Wake up, some of you. You will not desert this lady we are in search of. You will not abandon her on such a night and in such a state of mind as I know her to be in," said I, in an agony, and grasping his hand. "You are right, my dear, I won't. But I'll follow the other. Look alive here with them horses. Send a man forward in the saddle to the next stage, and let him send another forward again, and order four on, up, right through. My darling, don't you be afraid. These orders and the way in which he ran about the yard urging them caused a general excitement that was scarcely less bewildering to me than the sudden change. But in the height of the confusion, a mounted man galloped away to order the relays, and our horses were put to with great speed. My dear, said Mr. Bucket, jumping to his seat and looking in again, you'll excuse me if I'm too familiar. Don't you fret and worry yourself no more than you can help. I say nothing else at present, but you know me, my dear, now, don't you? I endeavored to say that I knew he was far more capable than I of deciding what we ought to do, but was he sure that this was right? Could I not go forward by myself in search of? I grasped his hand again in my distress, and whispered it to him of my own mother. My dear, he answered, I know, and would I put you wrong, do you think? Inspector Bucket. Now you know me, don't you? What could I say but yes? Then you keep up as good a heart as you can, and you rely upon me for standing by you, no less than by Sir Leicester Dedlock, Baronet. Now, are you right there? All right, sir. Off she goes, then. And get on, my lads. We were again upon the melancholy road by which we had come, tearing up the miry sleet and thawing snow, as if they were torn up by a water wheel. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.